You're listening to the Asymptote Podcast, and the idea for this episode all began with a coincidence. So this is something that happened to me a few months ago when I first moved to Portland, Oregon. I didn't really know anyone in the city at the time, so I was doing a lot of aimless wandering around, and on one of these walks I came across a little free library in the street, which is one of those boxes where people exchange unwanted books. So without thinking too much about it, I looked in there and picked up the first book that caught my eye, which happened to be a copy of Das und Heimlich by Sigmund Freud. Okay, so now fast forward a few hours. It's starting to get dark and I'm still walking around without much direction, and I suddenly hear what sounds like a violin. So in the tradition of all creepy stories, I follow the music, and what I find is a crooked little bookshop with a crowd gathered around this man. And when I look closer, I see that this guy looks weirdly like Sigmund Freud. And then I look closer still, and I see that he's reading out loud from a book by Freud. And the book is Das und Heimlich. So I go into the bookshop, I sit down, and what I hear is this.
Unintentional repetition or return. This transforms what would otherwise seem quite harmless into something uncanny, and forces us to entertain the idea of the fateful and the inescapable, when we should normally speak of chance.
Coincidence, Freud says, transforms the harmless into the uncanny. Uncanny is a strange word. It's kind of clunky and ungainly sounding and not all that poetic. But as we're about to delve into, it's a word with really fascinating roots and a lot of contradictory definitions. We all know the feeling of a blood-curdling shiver running down our spines. But when it comes to trying to describe what that really means or what caused it, often we're left with nothing but it was just creepy. There's something about uncanny feelings that is inherently inexplicable. In fact, I guess you could say that the word uncanny describes the feeling of inexplicability itself. Like, for example, the inexplicable and kind of silly coincidence of encountering Freud's definition of coincidence twice in one day. It turned out that what I had stumbled upon in that bookstore was an entire evening dedicated to the uncanny, a performance of short stories written by some of the best scary storytellers in world literature, exploring the mysterious and alluring phenomenon of getting the creeps. And the occasion was to celebrate the launch of a new literary anthology of the uncanny, edited by Marjorie Sandor.
My name is Marjorie Sandor, and I'm a writer and teacher at Oregon State University. And I've edited an anthology of short fiction called The Uncanny Reader, Stories from the Shadows.
So at the end of the evening, I spoke with Marjorie and asked her about what it was that drew her into the world of the uncanny.
I think a lot of books secretly start in childhood, and this one less secretly starts in childhood. There was a woman who helped my mother and babysat for us sometimes, and she used to tell ghost stories of the Los Angeles region and the San Gabriel Valley in particular, which I thought was just this bland suburb. But the more ghost stories she told about the area, the more I realized that the whole valley was underlain with layers and layers of ghost stories going all the way back to the earliest inhabitants, the Gabrielino Indians of that area. And it changed the way I thought about bland suburban landscapes and any other place I ever lived after. Made me realize that there was a great deal buried beneath the surface.
I also asked Marjorie about where the word uncanny originally came from.
Oh, yeah. Right. That's really interesting, too. So it's a very, very old word. I think they've found the earliest instances of it in literature in the 1600s. But it comes from the word canny, which comes from the word ken, which is actually a Norse word. And in ancient, now obsolete Scots, canny meant not only safe and cozy and practical, all those things that we associate with the word, but it also meant possessed of supernatural knowledge. So the interesting thing about the word is that it's already containing its own unness, it's undoing, it's unstable. And the same is true of the word that Freud used in composing his book called Das Unheimliche, which he said should be translated as the uncanny. He thought that was the closest word in English to the experience of the unheimlich, which is the unhomelike, the feeling that that which is closest to home is also most unknown to us. And that parent word, heimlich, means safe and cozy and homelike, but it also means private and hidden and secret. And so that word, too, has the same sort of property of instability that uncanny does, and starts to wobble before its little stepchild is born.
Yeah, and the idea, I suppose, also that not so much that it's unfamiliar, but that it's all too familiar.
It's all too familiar.
Yeah. Embedded in that.
That's right.
Word. Yeah.
Right. And one of the really wonderful definitions or expressions of the sensation of the uncanny that Freud gives is that the uncanny feeling comes from experiencing something that is so old and so repressed that we no longer recognize it. So it's actually known to us, but we've forgotten it. And it, when it comes out into the open again, it feels like it's new. But in fact, it's not new. It's just forgotten.
I love that. Like some kind of collective spiritual knowledge that we've tried to
hide
from
ourselves. That we've buried, right, as deeply as we can. And the other aspect of the uncanny that's important to me in terms of the way it happens in fiction is that I think it's most likely to happen to a reader when we begin in a world that is familiar and ordinary, and little by little that familiarity is undone in some way. Just one strange thing happens first, and then other strangenesses sort of open up from there. There's a great line from W.H. Auden in one of his poems. It's a crack in the teacup opens a lane to the land of the dead, which I love. It's a great sentence.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Okay, so although Marjorie and I both knew it was nothing but coincidence that brought us to that bookstore on that particular evening, we thought that just in case there was some kind of fateful omen at work, we really should make a podcast version of the anthology to share with you. So what you're about to hear is just that, an audio anthology of the uncanny. It'll be broken up into two episodes, and in this first one you're going to hear stories by Bruno Schultz, Ambrose Bierce, John Herdman, and Felisberto Hernandez. Welcome to the Uncanny Listener, stories from the shadows.
The uncanny is a crisis of the natural, touching upon everything that one might have thought was part of nature, one's own nature, human nature, the nature of reality and the world.
From The Birds by Bruno Schultz, translated by John Curran Davis.
Yellow and filled with boredom, the winter days were here. A threadbare and patchy, too short mantle of snow was spread over the reddened earth. It was too meager for the many roofs, which remained black or rust-colored, shingled roofs like arks and thatched cottages, concealing within them the smoke-blackened expanses of attics, charred black cathedrals bristling with ribs of rafters, purlins and joists, dark lungs of the winter gales. Each dawn uncovered new vent pipes and chimney stacks, sprung up in the night, blown out by the nocturnal gale, black pipes of the devil's organs. The chimney sweeps could not drive away the crows which perched in the evenings like living black leaves on the branches of the trees by the church, which rose up again, flapping, finally to cling once more, each to its own place on its own branch, while at daybreak they took to the air in vast flocks, clouds of soot, flecks of undulating and fantastic lamp black, smearing with their twinkling, cawing the dull yellow streaks of dawn. The days hardened in the cold and boredom like last year's bread loaves. They were cut with blunt knives, without appetite, in idle sleepiness. Father no longer left the house. He lit the stoves and studied the never-to-be-fathomed essence of fire. He savored the salty, metallic taste and smoky aroma of the winter flames, a cool caress of salamanders licking at the shiny soot in the throat of the chimney. He undertook with enthusiasm in those days all of the repairs in the loftier regions of the parlor. He could be seen at any time of day, squatting at the top of a stepladder as he tinkered at something close to the ceiling, around the cornices of the tall windows or the counterweights and chains of the hanging lamps. As house painters do, he used his stepladder like enormous stilts, and he felt happy in that bird's-eye perspective, close to the ceiling's painted sky, its arabesques and birds. We had not yet come to understand the lamentable background to these eccentricities, the gloomy complex that was ripening in the depths. As Father studied his huge ornithological compendiums, browsing through their colored plates, those fledged phantasms seemed to come flying out of them, filling the room with colorful fluttering, slivers of crimson, shreds of sapphire, verdigris, and silver. At feeding time, they comprised a varicolored, surging patch on the floor, a living carpet that was torn to pieces upon anyone's incautious entry, rent asunder into animated flowers, fluttering into the air to perch, at last, in the loftier regions of the parlor. A certain condor especially remains in my memory. An enormous bird with a bare neck, its face wrinkled and rank with excrescences. It was a gaunt ascetic, a Buddhist lama with impassive dignity in its whole demeanor, comporting itself in accordance with the strict etiquette of its illustrious tribe. As it sat opposite Father, unmoving, its monumental posture of the ancient Egyptian gods, its eye clouding over with a white film which spread from the edge to the pupil, enclosing it entirely in contemplation of its venerable solitude, and with its stone-hard profile, it seemed to be an older brother of my father. The same substance of its body, its tendons and its wrinkled, hard skin, the same dried-up, bony face with those same deep and horny sockets. Even Father's long and thin hands hardened into nodules and ending in his curled nails had their analogon in the condor's talons. Seeing it asleep, I could not resist the impression that I was looking at a mummy, the mummy shrunken by desiccation of my father. Nor, as I suspected, had this astonishing resemblance escaped Mother's notice, although we never pursued the topic. Characteristically, both the condor and my father used the same chamber pot.
Uncanny effects are made to be uncanny as crisis of imagination. The sense of ourselves as double, split, at odds with ourselves.
From One of Twins by Ambrose Bierce.
A letter found among the papers of the late Mortimer Barr. You ask me if, in my experience, as one of a pair of twins, I ever observed anything unaccountable by the natural laws with which we have acquaintance. As to that, you shall judge. Perhaps we have not all acquaintance with the same natural laws. You may know some that I do not, and what is to me unaccountable may be very clear to you. You know my brother John. That is, you knew him when you knew that I was not present, but neither you nor, I believe, any human being could distinguish between him and me if we chose to seem alike. Our parents could not. Ours is the only instance of which I have any knowledge of so close a resemblance as that. I speak of my brother John, but I am not at all sure that his name was not Henry and mine John. We were regularly christened, but afterward, in the very act of tattooing us with small distinguishing marks, the operator lost his reckoning, and although I bear upon my forearm a small H, and he bore a J, it is by no means certain that the letters ought not to have been transposed. During our boyhood, our parents tried to distinguish us more obviously by our clothing and other simple devices, but we would so frequently exchange suits and otherwise circumvent the enemy that they abandoned all such ineffectual attempts, and during all the years that we lived together at home, everybody recognized the difficulty of the situation and made the best of it by calling us both Jenry.
The uncanny applies to everything that was intended to remain secret, hidden away, and has come out into the open.
From The Devil and Dr. Tuberose by John Herdman.
It may be imagined that Dr. Tuberose entered the lecture hall considerably unnerved. He was made of stern stuff, however. Marcus Aurelius Tuberose was not a man of jelly. And in spite of every setback, he remained quietly but ruthlessly determined to do himself justice, to acquit himself with honor, to put his cards squarely on the table, to show up Pluckrose for what he was. In this first lecture, he was plunging right into the very heart of the matter, addressing Coleridge's distinction between fancy and imagination.
We have, above all, to ask ourselves what exactly Coleridge meant by imagination. We have to be clear about this before we can proceed any further. Did he mean by imagination a permanent, universal faculty of the human mind, equally possessed by all? Or did he mean by it what we nowadays usually understand the term to mean, namely a mere image-forming capacity, an ability to image to ourselves facts and possibilities and potentialities outside immediate reality, a capacity which different people possess in differing and variable degrees? Do we all possess imagination in the same way in which we all possess two arms and two legs?
He was about to continue when he noticed a hand raised about three-quarters of the way up the lecture hall to his right, near a side entrance. To his irritation and with a certain sinking of the heart, he saw that it belonged to an unhealthy-looking young man in a wheelchair, the lower moiety of whose person was concealed by a traveling rug.
Yes?
Excuse me, but it is not true that we all possess two arms and two legs.
Let me rephrase that. Do we all possess imagination in the same way in which we all possess a head? Or am I once again assuming too much? Is there anyone here without a head?
This sally was met with a horrified, stunned silence.
So we all have heads. But perhaps there is among us some smartass with two heads who would like to exploit his, or I had no doubt better add, her misfortune in order to score a debating point off of me.
At this, signs of disorder began to manifest themselves in the lecture hall. There was some laughter of a nervous kind, but also more ominous stirrings and mutterings.
I can see that I shall have to make a diversion in order to attempt to establish the distinction between essence and accident. The essence of a thing refers to that which is in itself, its inner universal condition. Its accidents refer to that which has befallen it accidentally. In other words, that which has happened to it. The essence of a thing is undisturbed by its accidents.
It wasn't an accident. I was born without legs.
The experience of a foreign body within oneself, or oneself as a foreign body.
From The Usher by Felisberto Hernandez, translated by Louis Haas.
In those days, I'd begun to slow down at my job, sick with silence. I was sinking into myself the way you sink into a swamp. My colleagues at work kept bumping into me. I'd become an aimless obstacle. The only thing I did well was polish my gold buttons. Once, I heard a colleague say, "Move it, hippo!" The word fell into my swamp, stuck to me, and sank in. It was followed by other insults that piled up in my mind like dirty dishes. By then, everyone avoided me, changing direction to stay out of my swamp. Sometime later, I was fired, and my foreign friend got me another job in a less elegant theater. Here, the women dressed badly, and there were no big tippers. Still, I tried to hang on. But on one of my most miserable days, something appeared before my eyes that made up for all ills. One night, I woke up in the dark silence of my room and, on the wall papered with purple flowers, I saw a light. I suspected at once that something extraordinary was happening to me, and I was not frightened. I moved my eyes sideways and the spot of light shifted with them. It was like the spot you see in the dark when you put out a lamp, but it lasted longer, and you could see through it. I lowered my eyes to the table and saw my bottles and other objects. There could be no doubt. The light was coming from my eyes and had been developing for some time. I stared at the back of my hand and saw my open fingers. Soon I felt tired. The light dimmed and I closed my eyes. In a minute, I opened them again to make sure I was not imagining things. I looked at the electric light bulb and it lit up with my light, so I was convinced. I smiled to myself. Who else in the world saw with his own eyes in the dark?
That's the end of part one, but we'll be back a month from now with the second installment of The Uncanny Listener. The next episode will feature Franz Kafka, Yoko Ogawa, Dean Paschal, Manzura S. Eldin, and an interview with the writer Adam Kotzko about how the uncanny creeps into TV shows, movies, adverts, and every aspect of popular culture today. In this episode, you heard original music by Jay Clark and readings by Tim Jensen, David Turkle, Elena Passarello, Joy Futrell, Ray Malowitz, Clay Wilwall, and Eric Altimus. Thanks so much to all of our performers. Thanks also go to Sally Decker, Yu Leong, and Joseph Sabo from Asymptote, Eric Gleesk and everyone at Oregon State University for letting us use their recording studio, and all of the writers, translators, and publishers who generously gave us permission to use these excerpts. And the biggest thank you of all goes to the wonderful Marjorie Sandor, editor of The Uncanny Reader. You can grab a copy of the book to read full versions of all the stories you heard here, as well as many more blood-curdling tales. See you next time.